Good afternoon, welcome. It's my sincere pleasure to introduce our speaker today, Dr. William Hines. He is a professor of geophysics in the Department of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at Purdue University. He has participated in many very interesting research programs, including siting of nuclear power plants and nuclear waste facilities, and has directed the research of over 90 PhD and MS students. Dr. Hines has also served as an advisor to many agencies, including NASA, the Department of Energy, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the U.S. Geological Survey, and he's a former senior editor of the Journal of Geophysical Research, Solid Earth. He'll be speaking to us today on the topic of nuclear waste disposal, problems, progress, and solutions. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Hines to Vanderbilt.
Thank you very much, and please take note that we're starting at 4:15, and which means that I can go through at least 5:15, if my watch is correct. It's a real pleasure to be here and to meet so many interesting geoscientists and engineers. I am certainly pleased to see once again my old friend Richard Stern from the New Madrid Rift Complex days of 30-some years ago, and Frank Parker. Needless to say, I won't say anything more about Jim Clark because of his introduction. It didn't take long enough. I found out that I'm practically related to the head of the Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences, David Furbish. David's father worked for me in the Lake Superior region back in 1952, 1953, so that was before David was around. But it's really great to make that association, and I've got to say that you have that same pretty smile that that your father had. With that, let's move along, because we do have a fair bit to cover in nuclear waste and problems, progress, and solutions. And let's see if we can make this remote work. Well, let's move to here. This past week, there were a couple of interesting front page articles that I picked up when I was in Washington, and it's really about what we're talking about here today. On the left, we have the front piece from the USA Today on January 31st, which reports on the International Panel on Climate Change's report, which for the first time gets the nations of the world to agree that the anthropogenic gases are having an effect upon our climate, and that the Earth's temperature is rising. And on the right, what we see is from the Wall Street Journal. This was a front page article in the Wall Street Journal. Power producers rush to secure nuclear sites. What that means is that as part of this nuclear renaissance, and part of this problem that we see developing as a result of trying to minimize the anthropogenic gases, that we are going to see within the next 20 years or so, 20 to 30 new nuclear power plants in the United States. What we will be discussing today is the linchpin to that. Without waste disposal, proper waste disposal, you're not going to have the nuclear power plants. California, for example, has a law that we cannot have a nuclear power plant built in the state until there is a place for the spent nuclear fuel. And that is directly controlling and involved with the global warming, with the climate change. What happened is back in, as many of us will remember, back in 1973, the Nixon administration said that as a result of the Arab oil embargo, that the United States would become energy independent. Of course, that was a fallacy from Web 1, but it was a goal, like the Manhattan Project or the Apollo mission, something to try to be achieved. As a result, many of us geotypes became involved in looking for uranium and also in the siting of nuclear power plants, because there was a ramp up in the number of nuclear power plants to take the place of electrical power generation plants that were being driven, that was using oil or gas for the energy. But then comes 1979, and we have the Three Mile Island accident. I didn't say disaster, but I said accident. There, no one was killed as a result of the Three Mile Island accident, and there were no lethal radiation exposures. But nonetheless, it changed the mood of the country against nuclear power, and the cost of nuclear power increased dramatically as a result, forcing it out of business. And the at that time then, following 79, there were very few nuclear power plants completed, and those that were online were terminated. However, what we're seeing today is a nuclear power renaissance, and that we saw in that Wall Street Journal article, if you will. This is a result of the run-up in hydrocarbon prices, which we all have been subjected to in the last couple of years, and also the realization that the source of our hydrocarbons are from nations in which there can be a great deal of instability. And of course, we have the whole problem of minimizing the carbon dioxide as well as the other anthropogenic gases in the atmosphere to avoid global warming, and thus we see a nuclear power resonance. And we'll whip through these. And when we discuss nuclear power resonance, we can ask some questions. What needs to be done to enhance nuclear power? Well, one of the things that we need to do is we need to have a change in the attitude regarding nuclear power by the people of this country. That is something that I think is being turned around. Even the Union of Concerned Scientists have found nuclear power to be much more appealing than global warming. So there is a change in attitude. We must also have a safe, secure source of uranium. And many of you may have noted a Wall Street Journal article a month or so ago about the fact that the uranium ore has increased in price tenfold over the past 5 years. There are additional sources of uranium in this country, and we do have those, but we need a safe and secure source of uranium. Nuclear power must also be cost competitive. At the present time, nuclear power does not compete with coal as a electrical power generation. But what we are going to see, and I really believe this, that what we're going to see in the near future is that we will have a surcharge put upon a coal generation, coal-fed generating plants. That is going to be imposed because of the carbon dioxide they're releasing into the atmosphere, and will be on the basis of federal rules and regulations. And the coal companies, the coal generating power plants, are really getting ready for that. And so nuclear power will become much more competitive. But the 800-pound gorilla in all of this is the disposing of the spent nuclear fuel from the power plants. Without that, we will not see a regeneration, a renaissance, if you will. So why should we be concerned about radioactive waste disposal? And I don't have to go through that with this group. You're all very knowledgeable on this. We need to remove the waste, the radioactive waste, for a long time to protect ourselves from human health and genetic effects. And of course, this varies depending upon the isotopic composition of the waste. Now, I'm not going to bore you with a lot of details here, but I a few things need to be said about units. Rate of decay is one of the units that we see in terms of the activity. And this is really the disintegrations per second. And we commonly use the unit Curie there. That's the one that you're most apt to see. We can also talk about the energy released as a result of the radiation, and that's in terms of the rads, the radiation released in this number of joules per gram. But the unit that is very common to us is in this whole nuclear waste focusing is the REM, or more commonly the millirem, because most of the effects are so small, we use the millirem. And a REM, it stands for a Rontgen equivalent man. So when you see, or when I say we have so many REMs, you will know that this is Rontgen equivalent man. And really refers to the energy that is received by man. We also know that natural radiation is around us all the time. At the current time, we don't know what that is exactly, but it is something around this 300 millirem. Don't worry about that unit, but about 300 millirem, with the largest part really coming from the 200 millirems coming from the air that we breathe, commonly in the form of radon, one of the radioactive gases of short half-life in the uranium decay chain. In addition to these normal radiation, we also see that there's medical radiation, which probably gives us another 18-20%. What does that really mean? Well, we could talk about this in terms of lifetime mortality risks. And this is in a log scale, of course, tenfold each time, percent. And we see public air travel here as about 0.02%, drowning about 0.1, and 100 millirem background is something here around 0.3. But 300 millirem is about 8/10 of a percent. 1,000 millirem, which is a high background, which you might receive if you stood up there on Pike's Peak, where you got a lot of cosmic radiation, you might be upwards of 1,000 millirem. And we'll be comparing numbers to that. We want to remove this from the human, the radioactive waste from the human environment. But what is the effect of lack of disposal sites? Well, first of all, two things. It may inhibit medical research and industrial uses. And this is largely then in the form of waste that we call low-level waste. But for our purposes here, my focus is the fact that the lack of disposal sites may inhibit the development of new nuclear electrical power generation plants, and this is this high-level waste. This whole problem of radioactive waste has been in a bit of disarray, and I think it's pretty well summarized by this very erudite presentation. That's not a cartoon, incidentally. Westward hurdle ho, northward ho, southward ho, and now eastward ho. We're running out of options in terms of how to dispose of nuclear waste. And what I'm going to try to do is to hope that to show that we can indeed do something about the disposal of nuclear waste. I like this quote from Winston Churchill because it very much relates to what's going on today. In the end, America will do the right thing, but along the way, they exhaust every other possibility. And frankly, we're just about at the point of having exhausted every other possibility, so now it's time to get the job done. There are many methods of disposal of nuclear waste, and I'm sure Dr. Parker has given these to you ad nauseum. Dilute and disperse is the easiest. There were some countries that were doing this up to the relatively recent time. And in fact, the U.S., as Frank will tell you, dumped a lot of radioactive waste both off the East Coast and the West Coast of the United States at one time. Another possibility here, but of course this violates the law of the ocean and is something that is totally unacceptable on a national or international level. We can also concentrate and contain, and we can use dry cast storage. I can't get used to the fact that I've got to keep pumping this thing. And this shows a dry cask storage of waste at a nuclear power plant. The normal mode of storing the waste at this plant has exceeded the volume that's available. And so what we see is concentrating and containing in these monitored retrievable storage facilities. But then we also have delay and decay. And this is the geological disposal. Been selected by every nation that is disposing of its waste to use underground disposal, subsurface disposal. And the reason for that is that we can have a long-term isolation as feasible, that's from the biosphere. There's minimum maintenance and burden to future man. There's this intergenerational equality, if you will. And also, from my standpoint, it's readily possible to employ defensive depth using both geologic and engineering barriers. And this to prevent the transport of radionuclides to the environment. Now, something has to be said about the types of nuclear waste. And I've noticed in my conversations around the departments here today that there's maybe some confusion about all of these. There are a lot more types of waste than this, Tenorm, et cetera, et cetera. But basically, in the order in which they occur in the fuel cycle, we have uranium mill tailings, low-level waste, transuranic waste, and high-level waste, although there isn't unanimity on what high-level waste is. DOE has its definition, NRC has its own definition. And I point out here that this is a source-derived classification. Has doesn't really have anything to do with the number of REMs, the energy released. Uranium mill tailings are the first thing that we encounter. These are residue from the mining and milling of uranium ores. And in several states around in the western part of the U.S., we find these tailings ponds. And these largely consist of unstable daughters of uranium and thorium, particularly radon, the gas. This is the largest volume of our radioactive waste, but fortunately, it's the lowest radioactivity. How is this managed? Well, basically, it's covered and contained. In other words, you cover it with a clay cap. You cover it with cobbles to prevent the fines from blowing out and away, and so you have covered and contained it. Let me show you a couple of these ponds. This is a pond near the Atlas Mine, near San Juan, I believe it is. And this is a closer shot of this. This is the fines that are left around a drying up pond associated with that mine. Here we see a tailings facility which has been covered over with cobbles, and these cobbles are usually a few inches to a half a foot in size. This is not a uranium mill tailings, but this is very important in regard to uranium mill tailings. This is a uranium mine, and they're it's up in northwestern Nebraska. I was able to visit there with some other members of the committee not too long ago, near a little village there. And these are all wells. And this is part of a new procedure that is being used, which is called in situ leach, in which one drills holes into an ore body, and this is a roll front deposit, drills holes into the ore body, sends down a oxidizing fluid, and that then makes the uranium soluble, and you pump it out at collector wells, and you have, number one, no exposure of miners or mill workers, and you have no mill tailings. The problem of this is, of course, and this is a problem that Jim and I are reacting to right now, of trying to keep the groundwater pure, and that you don't have this leaking off into aquifers or potential aquifers, and seeing that the proper regulations are put into effect. Low-level waste. Well, low-level waste covers a lot of sins. It's a misnomer because there are some low-level waste that are as radioactive as are some high-level waste. There are four classes, A, B, C, and greater than class C with increasing radiation. Fortunately, 97% of the volume is in the lowest level. But this represents the radioactivity from research institutions like yours and hospitals, but primarily nuclear plant refuse. That makes up about 50%. And there is an increasing amount from decommissioning of nuclear power plants that have been closed down. Generally, but not necessarily, low activity, and we have a short half-life, 90% is less lost within about 100 years. Now, there are many ways of disposing of this, and not many of them are very good. One is ocean dumping that we've seen, and there were also burial sites at various places, Maxey Flats, West Valley, various places around the country. They've all been closed down. The 1980 Low-Level Waste Policy Act enacted placed the responsibility with the states, and the states were supposed to set up compacts to handle their own waste. The states asked for this, they got it, and they've never done anything with it. Currently, there are only three sites in the United States where we can get rid of the waste. There is the Hanford site, which accepts the Class A through C, this handles much of the decommissioning material. There's EnviroCare in Utah, which handles only Class A. Texas is a new application that looks like it might go, but many things happen along the way. Ward Valley, California, one was all set up, and then they were not able to get the land, was not released by the Secretary of the Interior. And then there's Barnwell. Barnwell is a particularly important one because it handles both, it handles Class A through C, and it's in the eastern United States where most of the power plants are, and this is most of the waste. The shipping costs are really get to be excessive in this. But the only problem here is that Barnwell is scheduled to close down in next year, except for the refuse from a couple of states. There's more that could be said here. The low-level waste concerns, we know the NIMBY problem is around us. There are no waste sites developed by the state compacts, and adequate site selection and implementation is going to require a considerable amount of work, and it certainly requires the adequate geology, particularly from the water standpoint. And one thing is that at the current, that in contrast to the past, no liquids are stored. But solid, stable waste packages are used. To give you an example, well, I guess I wanted to say there that, if I can get it here, there are decreasing quantities. There's been a vast there's been a tremendous decrease in the amount of quantity of the radioactivity, of the volume of the low-level waste, because people have been trying to minimize their costs, and the charges are by volume. But the net result is that we have increasing concentrations of radioactivity in the low-level waste. Jim, I don't know whether they've seen these kinds of photographs before, but this is a Barnwell, and it shows the kind of facility. The clay here is a tertiary clay that is pretty impermeable, but we do know that there's a plume of tritium going from this site. And let me see what else we have here. And this is how these are closed off. The trench are covered over. You notice the cobbles there, and both a natural and an artificial cover with the monitoring wells. Transuranic waste is interesting from the standpoint that if we go to reprocessing of fuel, we'll end up of spent nuclear fuel, we'll end up with a lot of the transuranic waste, which are now being stored in WIPP. And one of the reasons I wanted to bring this up is because WIPP is the Waste Isolation Pilot Project, and thus the name WIPP. Where we're storing the transuranic waste today. And this is a very successful disposal of nuclear waste. And these are waste that you really want to get out of the human environment. The transuranic waste are materials that are contaminated with a variety of radionuclides and other man-made radioactive elements. Heavier than uranium, having an atomic number higher than 92, that are largely a byproduct of weapon production. But these would also be a byproduct of the reprocessing of fuels. They have long half-lives, so they have to be stored away. And they are stored at these DOE sites, but they're being relocated to WIPP since 1999. And this is a salt formation in the southeastern part of New Mexico, Carlsbad, New Mexico, and it's at a depth of about 2,150 feet. One of the interesting things, if you ever visit WIPP, and I guess you will be visiting WIPP, it's very interesting because you drive up to the area and you drive by these headframes of potash mines. And there are oil wells around, and as a result, one of the major concerns about WIPP was the problem that there might be human intrusion, and that when looking for natural resources here into the future, when some of our history is lost, there would be human intrusion into the stored waste. And this is just a shot of the WIPP facility and the road transport, the loaders that carry the transuranic waste from WIPP to WIPP from the Idaho National Environmental Lab. And these are tunnels in the salt formation. And this is another shot of the transuranic waste in the containers. And as a result of natural forces, as well, and accelerated by the heat given off by this transuranic waste, the salt will gradually entomb these waste at a depth of about 2,200 feet. Now, the high-level waste comes from two sources: the spent nuclear fuel. Which comes from our nuclear electrical power generation, and the liquid and solid waste from weapons production that's stored at DOE sites. According to the NRC, both of these constitute high-level waste. The DOE separates, and so don't get confused. They talk about spent nuclear fuel and high-level waste as being separate entities. DOE is now scheduled to take title to the spent nuclear fuel for disposal in a high-level waste repository, and I think they were supposed to do this starting in about 1990. Well, they probably didn't make that. The spent nuclear fuel rods are very thin, about a quarter of an inch, and several meters long, and they are put into fuel assemblies, and this is what is being stored. And on site, they are stored in these swimming pools, which are now filling up, despite the fact that they've re-racked and re-racked to try to make more volume available to the waste. And they take the oldest waste, that's the coolest waste, and many nuclear power plants put this in a dry cask storage. The comparison of radionuclide hazard from spent nuclear fuel and an ore body is rather interesting. At one time, the natural ore body was taken as the, since we're taking the waste out, how soon is it going to be like the natural situation, a natural ore body? And if we look at the slide on the right here, this is 10 to the 1, this is 10 to the 8 years. In other words, at about 10 million years, the spent nuclear fuel finally reaches the radiation that we might anticipate from a natural ore body. And this, of course, is dependent upon the various radionuclides involved. For example, cesium and strontium give very high dose rates, number of curies, but they have a very short half-life, and they are essentially down to negligible levels in 1,000 years. So these are things we want to stay away from for a long period of time. And these are the current high-level waste storage facilities around the United States. There are some 150 of them, and even Purdue University here, because of its storage of some of the waste associated with its reactor. 50% of the population of the United States lives within 100 kilometers, 60 miles, of one of these sites. And the whole idea here is that we want to get this moved to the Yucca Mountain. Many of these are nuclear power plants, about 105 of them. There are probably about 450 nuclear electrical power generation plants in the around the world, where they're rapidly being built around the world, and we'll see a lot more. Well, there are challenges facing us in this nuclear waste disposal. There are science challenges, and there are political challenges. The science is challenges by characterizing the site without destroying its integrity. The best thing to do, of course, is to dig the thing out, and then you know what you've got, or you cut it up with so many holes that you destroy its integrity, and that's not what you want to do. But our real problem is predicting the geological processes and events, as well as the performance of the engineered barriers, the barriers, that man-made barriers, the waste containers, the drip shields, and so forth. Oh, and the transport of nuclear of radionuclides over a long time with a minimum of uncertainty. This is our challenge. In terms of the political system, if you were a senator or a congressman, you would be concerned about the premature release of radionuclides. And of course, this is what the Nevada congressional delegation is so concerned about. But we still have to protect the health and safety of the nation by subsurface burial. And we also want to limit the impact on future generations. If Congress has ever stood up in its life, it was when they passed the Nuclear Waste Policy Act of 1982, when they said, we're going to handle our own garbage. That's a great start. Unfortunately, that kind of thinking has not been pervasive since that time. And then we also have this problem, this political problem, really need to fulfill the growing demand for electrical power from non-fossil fuels. If we look in there, you know, everybody has their own illustration. This is the World Energy Outlook, recent appraisal of the situation. And this is the total world energy. And what we see here in yellow is the nuclear. And what we have is the oil, gas, and coal, and these are the three big bombs up here, and we're sitting about in here someplace, and what we're seeing is that there is going to be a large increase in the use of these, and of course we want to minimize that because of the global warming problem that we've talked about briefly. And I suspect that what we're going to do is see a lot more in terms of nuclear power. At least I hope so, because I think it's the better of the lesser of evils. This is a comparison of the total life cycle of emissions of carbon dioxide from various electrical generating systems. Coal is the big one here, and geothermal, solar, wind, etc. They all have some. Nuclear has some. It's not discharging any carbon dioxide, but what it is doing is that in part of the mining process, there is the use of fossil fuels, and thus we have electrical power generation. So that's, and I guess that I really wanted to say, one of the things here is that 40% of the greenhouse gases globally today are from electrical power generation. So if we can try to minimize that electrical power generation from fossil fuels, we've gone a long way towards handling these anthropogenic gases. And this shows the source of emission of emission-free electricity. Nuclear power is by far the largest. Hydro and solar, wind, and the others are small. There's a limited amount that we can do with those. Hopefully, we'll be able to do something more in terms of the increasing the amount of use of nuclear power. Now, all of this is met by the implementation by the interacting agencies, by EPA, which sets the standards, NRC, which establishes the regulations to see that the standards are met, and then the Department of Energy, which develops the license application for the nuclear power plants. And of course, all of this is fed into by the nuclear, by the other stakeholders like the state and so forth. In 1957, the National Academy was asked to come up with how can they handle a disposal of waste, and they came up with delay and decay in groundwater, and this led to something that Frank showed me a photograph of from this the Lyons, Kansas site, which was the original site that was selected and turned out to be much too close to humans. And I'm going to run through these rather rapidly. Here we have the 1982 Nuclear Waste Policy Act. It provided for the first time for a national repository and then set up EPA, NRC, and DOE regulations, Code of Federal Regulations. Originally, these were generic in nature. Originally, these were for any nuclear power plant, high-level waste disposal site. Then they were modified as a result of the 1992 Act, which changed them from the subsystems requirements on a general basis to a performance based only on for Yucca Mountain. I could spend some time here, but I think Frank has already done this with many of you. He's talked about the nationwide review, which led to the study for three sites. I've got to digress for just one moment. There probably is too much to say here, but some years ago, when DOE started this whole project of trying to find a high-level waste site, my friends up at Argonne called me and said, "Bill, would you come up and discuss a problem with us? Maybe you'd like to have a contract." And so I said, "Well, you know, what are you doing?" And they said, "Just come on up and we'll chew for a bit." So I went up to Argonne and they explained that they had the contract with DOE for the Crystalline Rock project to try to find a site for a nuclear for nuclear waste disposal, spent nuclear fuel. in the Midwest, in Crystalline Rock. And they said, you know, would you like to take this project over at Purdue? And I said, you know, that's really doesn't have to be done. You know, you don't have to hire us. I can tell you where to go to find that site. I can, you know, I know the site already, just what you're saying. And they said, well, what is it? And I said, well, it's the Wolf River batholith, which any good Midwestern geologist knows is a 1,500-year-old anorogenic granite, 60 miles long, 60 kilometers long, about 20 kilometers wide, 6 kilometers deep. Nothing has happened to that in 1,500 million years. Nothing happens in Wisconsin. And they said, well, where is this located? And they said, well, it's, I said, well, it's just located outside of Green Bay, Wisconsin. They said, forget it. You can't, when you run this crystalline project, rock project, you can't even talk about Wisconsin because of the congressional delegation. Many good sites were eliminated strictly on the basis of political considerations. And in 1987, this was amended to study only Yucca Mountain. This is commonly known as the Screw Nevada Bill by Congress. Ike Winograd and others that were pushing this had many good reasons. And in fact of the matter, it's not a bad site. It's remote location from inhabitants. Those of you that are going out there will certainly see that. It has proximity to Nevada test site with a large geological database. Translate that to mean that there's already been over 1,000 nuclear weapons detonated underground in the site, and it's already all fouled up with radiation. But there is a good database. The favorable geological formations. Tight formations, they aren't nowhere near as tight as they thought they were back in 87, and permitting, and this allowed for good construction and defense of depth. And the precipitation, 16, 17 millimeters, 16, 17 centimeters per year, it is a desert climate with low precipitation and high evapotranspiration, and a water table that is a couple of thousand feet deep in Yucca Mountain. So these are all very good characteristics. Let's see where we're headed from here. In 1992, the site characterization was finally initiated, and that was a result of legal action which forced the state to give permits for people to get onto the land to start conducting the studies. And that site characterization has just about been completed now. Most of it, of course, is sitting in front of those CRT screens. In 1995-1996, the National Academy of Science recommended a change in standards. This is a result of something that was dictated in the 1992 Energy Policy Act. And the National Academy of Science suggested that the time of compliance be stretched out to time of maximum dosage from the site, which translates to about a million years. We can discuss that more through any questions that you have. And 2007, we are seeing that there are revised EPA standards and NRC regulations, which are now taking into account going to 10,000 from 10,000 years, which it was previously. Oop! If I can go back there. I want to point out a couple of things. Do we have the change from 10,000 years to a million years, the standard that will probably be coming out from the EPA within days is that 50 millirem per year for the first 10,000 years, and that's as was previously established back in the 80s, and that in three and after 10,000 years, we jump from 15 to 350 millirem per year. Now, that plus 350 million millirem puts Amargosa Valley, where the critical group is located, at about a par with the city of Denver, and that's their rationale. So this is the location of Yucca Mountain. It's out there in the Basin and Range, about 100 miles north of northwest of Las Vegas, and the NTS is right here, so it's right on the border with NTS. It's rather interesting to understand where the Yucca Mountain repository of funding comes from. The source of the funding is that the users pay at the rate of about a tenth of a cent per kilowatt hour that go into the waste disposal fund. And this brings in something of the order of magnitude of $500 million per year. This has been going on for some time, so that with the interest, this fund has grown considerably. But this is not earmarked for nuclear waste, despite the fact that that's what it's for. It goes into the general budget, and as a result, Congress can spend that money as they wish and give as much of it to the Department of Energy and to characterize the site and to NRC to regulate it as they feel fit to do. And so it's very easy for Congress to dip into this fund just like they do into the Social Security fund. This is by far and away the most costly, if you will, geological study ever made. Costs to date are probably of the order of magnitude of $8 billion, maybe a little bit more than that. The ultimate cost is probably upwards of $40 billion, and that's probably being a bit conservative. The Yucca Mountain occurs in felsic Miocene welded tufts that come from the Timber Mountain caldera, which sits up here. This is the repository. Will, if it really goes through, will be right in that area underneath these welded tufts that dip at about 10 degrees to the east. We're looking to the north here, and this is the Solitario Canyon Fault, which is a major basin range fault. This is a shot then essentially turning around and shooting to the south. This is the Amargosa Valley here, and this is not a very good reproduction. It doesn't come through well, but I wanted to show you that's Lathrop Wells. That's the 80,000 year old alkali basalt that is within about 15 kilometers of the site. There's another volcano that is a million years old, that's about 8 kilometers just off to the west here. This is a kind of a false color image, and it shows a lot. This is Yucca Mountain, the Yucca Mountain site, and this is the Solitario Canyon and the Windy Wash Fault, which are the western margin of this block, and there's another series of faults that extend through here, the Stagecoach and one of the canyon faults. These are some Pliocene basic volcanics, this is a volcanic zone up here, not far from the site itself, and red cone, black cone, little cone, and of course Lathrop Wells. This is Crater Flat, which is considered to be the probable source zone of future volcanism. Along the side here, we have the Bear Mountains and the Bear Mountain Fault, which is a steeply dipping fault that gives rise to this depression that we have the accumulation of these felsic tufs and the alluvium from the surrounding highlands. I should point out, this is Highway 95, and the critical group, or the what is now called REMI, the recently maximally exposed individual, lies here close to Highway 95, about 18 kilometers from the site. This is a schematic of the waste repository. This is the ESF, which started off in, when I first got into this business, as was the exploration shaft facility, because it was going to be done by the entryway was going to be by shaft. Then they decided, because of the TRB, to do a drift and add it in from the eastern side of the mountain, and so they have this tunnel board. Exploration study facility, and the total length of this is somewhere around 8 kilometers. The proposed emplacement drifts are shown here, but that's still the final decision of that has not been released, if it's been made, by the Department of Energy. And this shows a cross section of the site. The Teba Canyon is the ridge former up here. It's pretty densely welded tuff, and this is the Tonopah Springs, the crystalline, which the crystal pored zone. This is about 200 meter thick welded tuff. It's fairly tight, except for the faults. And the repository is supposed to be right in here at about that level. One of the important things about this is that it's underlain by the Calico Hills Formation, which is a poorly welded tuff, which is high in zeolites and therefore is supposed to be a trap for some of the radionuclides if they do escape from the repository. Now, the potential adverse conditions at Yucca Mountain risk from an uncertainty in predicting for a million years. This is a tough problem. One is the igneous activity. The other is the earthquakes. And the primary effect of earthquakes is really collapse in on the collapse of the drifts, so that material comes down and falls into and the drifts hitting the waste containers and accelerating the possibility of a corrosion. The water flux into the repository is another major concern. When this was first developed as a site, it was felt that the infiltration rate was something like a millimeter per year and was totally matrix flow, which meant that no one had that ever made that assumption or prediction was ever on the mountain, because you have to be pretty blind not to see the faults that transcend the whole thing. And in fact, the matter is the chlorine 36, the bomb pulse chlorine 36. That was found in this exploration study facility showed that transport of the 300 meters from the surface to the repository level was of the order of magnitude of 50 years, not the hundreds to thousands of years that was the initial thought, and one of the reasons for selecting Yucca Mountain. We also have to be concerned about the integrity of the waste and the waste containers and the whole business of thermal loading. This is still up in the air, and the problem here is that originally the DOE wanted to increase the thermal loading, and that means bringing all of the waste kind of together, and it ends up with heating the site considerably. But when you heat the site, what you do is you change the mineralogy, you change the process of movement of the water, and a lot of things happen that are very difficult to predict. So this is undergoing intensive investigation and will be, I can promise you, the subject of intense scrutiny during the review of the license application, which is due in slightly over, I'm going to jump past that. This shows a schematic of how the DOE might put have the drifts developed. As soon as it was discerned that the flow of water from the surface, the infiltration of water from the surface to the repository level through the faults of fractures was very rapid, and probably led to more than a millimeter per year of infiltration, as it was hoped, that probably at least 10 times that amount. They decided to put in drip shields. These are titanium drip shields. You can't imagine the expense of that, but that is to protect the waste packages, and the waste packages are made out of a very special chromium molybdenum alloy, alloy 22, which is then surrounds a inch thick stainless steel package, and all of this is designed to minimize the corrosion. The problem with seismic activity is that we can have collapse of the roof here, despite the various workings here, collapse of the roof, and dropping down, injuring the drip shields and the waste containers, fostering corrosion. One of the major problems at Yucca Mountain, as we've talked about in terms of adverse conditions, is the possibility of volcanic action. And volcanic action is the performance studies indicate that in the first 10,000 years, that the major source of release to the public is through volcanic action. And we have here the 80,000 and the 1 million year olds. I'm going to move on. And this is shot from on top of Yucca Mountain, or this is the top of Yucca Mountain, if I can find it here. And these are the cones here. As you can see, they're in close proximity. And this is the Lathrop Wells scoria cone. It's being mined out. It'll disappear here in not too long. I kid you not. They're building Las Vegas with this scoria cone, which is about 300 feet high. One of the things that we try to do is we try to determine the risk that we get from volcanic action, and that is a matter of considering the probability and the consequences of volcanic activity. As we know, predicting volcanic action for 10,000 years or a million years is a real difficult problem. We don't have the theories. We don't have the technology to do that. So when, in the absence of good hard data, what do? You call in these guys with briefcases that are called experts, and you put them in a room, and they decide how what they think was going to happen. And the 10 experts back in 1996 came out with the fact that there was about a 10 to the minus 7th to 10 to the minus 8th chance of volcanic activity intersecting the repository. Since magnetics is one of my loves, I've got to show this. We were on the back of DOE for years to do a proper magnetic survey, and this is the high-resolution magnetic survey, the results of the high-resolution magnetic survey. And what we see here are these volcanics showing up, because what is concerned here is that there may be volcanics that are still of quaternary age, but that have been hidden by the debris from erosion of the highlands, and that they are just not visible. And this, the magnetics gives us a way of looking into the subsurface. And this just shows a geologist doing the work in the ESF. That feature was mapped in great detail. We also have to be concerned. Anyone that has taken a high school geology course knows that the Basin and Range is a very seismically active area. Tomorrow we'll try to discuss this in more detail, but here we have the seismicity in Nevada and adjacent California. On July 29th, 1992, there was Little Skull Mountain earthquake just a few miles away from Yucca Mountain at a magnitude 5.6. Cost about $1 million to the characterization site. Okay, what is the status then of nuclear waste disposal? And I'm going to follow some notes here so I can get across a couple of points. In my view, and I'm speaking strictly from Bill Hines' viewpoint, I should have said that at the beginning, that I'm not representing Purdue University, AC&W, Nuclear Regulatory Commission. I'm speaking directly for myself. But it seems to me that there is little question that the disposal of nuclear waste is in trouble in the nation. And I hope I've tried to get that point across to you. These problems are caused by schizophrenic legislative decisions, particularly Congress, but also by the states. Budget and program inconsistencies, which have led to poor science at times. Changing standards and regulations, I've tried to show you that. Changing standards and regulations, and also political priorities. Poor interaction between the public and the governmental agencies, and that's just you have to have that. It's just a first priority item. And the abundance of declarative truths by so-called experts. These are that Yucca Mountain is a poor site, Yucca Mountain is a good site, as a declarative truth. Nonetheless, I believe that progress is being made. There is a mood in our nation to get the job done and done correctly. A combination of careful science and technology and engineering, as well as a heavy dose of responsible politics, is needed, and certainly the ability to apply good science and technology engineering is there. The nuclear waste disposal problem is much more of a political problem than it is a scientific problem. From a technical and scientific viewpoint, the waste problem and Yucca Mountain are tractable. I am much less positive about our politics, but we do need to encourage politicians to stand up and to make the right decision. And maybe global warming is enough to trigger it. Maybe it'll take a little bit more than that. The no action alternative is really making a deliberate decision that is potentially harmful to the people of our nation, and we must see that it does not happen. Retiring Commissioner McGaffigan, who has just left the NRC commission, has been quoted, and I think some of you have seen this, has been quoted in the Las Vegas Review Journal. I think Yucca Mountain has been beset by bad law, bad regulatory policy, bad science policy, bad personnel policy, bad budget, oh my gosh, throughout its history. Each year that passes, we are not going to get any closer to Yucca Mountain under the current circumstances. That's a pretty heavy indictment by a man that is there right on the firing line and has been for the last 9 years, something like that. And I feel as if I've sat in his office many times and discussed these problems with him. And in the commentary that you don't get in the Los Angeles newspaper, is that McGaffigan says that despite this 20-odd years of characterization, that we do not see any fatal flaws in the Yucca Mountain situation. Well, I'd like to finish up, and I think this is my last slide, with a quotation from Dixie Lee Ray, and Frank probably knew Dixie Lee, who left the chairmanship of the commission and went on to become governor of the state of Oregon. And I think that she put it just about right. Now, final decisions are made, and this is referring to nuclear waste disposal, quite rightly by the people and their elected representatives. You know, we can't put it just in the hands of the scientists and the engineers. It is especially important, then, that responsible scientists and their institutions, such as yours, make sure that scientific facts get a proper airing in the media and to our nation, so that we can all make intelligent decisions about the new technologies and scientific issues that affect our lives. I'm an eternal optimist. I think that we can do this, and I think we not only can do it, but we must do it. Thank you very much.
We got off to a little bit of a late start, Bill. Would you take
it? Was quite a bit of a late start, as I saw.
Well, we were on geologic time.
Right. I'm just kidding. I'd be happy to entertain any questions. I didn't say answer any questions. I said entertain.
Are we going to have to redo the geology again at Yucca Mountain, or are the facts sufficient to know what's going on? Because what I heard was that years ago, because there wasn't a proper chain of custody and so on of samples, that the U.S. Geological Survey, who started out, I think, had to do everything again. Well, this has to be, will somebody make us do it all over again?
Are you talking about the email problem? The USGS email problem? I think that's what you're talking about. And that is some very disparaging remarks that were made about the program and how it was being conducted by some members of the U.S. Geological Survey, and particularly the hydrology group. And incidentally, there are two divisions in the USGS, the Geological Division and the Hydrology Division. The Geology Division became so disturbed about what was going on at Yucca Mountain that they refused to work at Yucca Mountain. And so the work that has been going on, if you wanted to continue work, even if you were a structural geologist, you had to join the Hydrology Division. What happened there is I think we all know some of the principles involved. These are the archetypical, quintessential, arrogant scientists that wants to have no one looking over their shoulder. And the problem really revolved around quality assurance. And maybe there were some pretty good clods running the quality assurance program at one time. But these people were there to make certain that there was a paper trail. And that was an adequate paper trail of how things were done. I mean, I've had, in my previous existence, like you, I've had a number of NRC contracts. And I would have a person from the NRC coming in and going through my computer codes to make certain that they were computing what they should be computing. And the first thing you do is rock, because I'm a great scientist, and why should you be questioning me or how I do things? Well, they weren't questioning how I do things. They wanted to make certain that there was paper trail. So a lot of people became upset. A lot of scientists became upset. What has happened is that the Department of Energy has gone in there and redone all of the work that was under question by those emails. So all of that has been redone and restudied by independent groups. And there's no change. It was mainly involved evapotranspiration rates. It's silly. Are we going to have to redo things? I thought what you were leading to, Dick, was because we're moving from 10,000 to maybe a million now, or thereabouts. Are we going to have to redo that, the science? No, because there's a provision, at least in the draft revision of 40 CFR 197, the EPA standard, which sneaks in a phrase that you can use the appraisal for the first 10,000 years as an appraisal for the entire million years. So there is not much that has to be done, but there is some that has to be done in the seismic area. We're looking both at pre-closure, post-closure seismic issues now, and if you run the post-closure out to a million years, what you end up with are accelerations that we've never seen in the Western United States. I mean, they're totally geologically unreasonable. Yeah.
What do you think about the idea of taking the Yucca Mountain program away from the Department of Energy and establishing a quasi-governmental organization for it?
You mean like TVA or something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, that's been raised a number of times. I think that I think you have to realize that this isn't just DOE waste. WIP is a good example of just DOE handling the process through, and there was no NRC did not regulate WIP. But I think in this spent nuclear fuel, commercial fuel, we're probably better off to stay with the current situation, and frankly, changing horses in the middle of this stream sounds like really a bad idea to me. I'm sure that there's a lot more, there are a lot of very smart people out there, and Ed McAdvocate, of course, suggests that people like Reserve and Garrick and others would serve us very well. But there are a lot of smart people in NRC and DOE, and I think they're capable of doing the job. You know, I think the real problem is how are we going to solve the Nevada nut? That's the real problem. That's the political problem. Here you are, Harry Reid, who is dedicated to the destruction of Yucca Mountain as a repository site, and he's majority leader, of course, in the Senate. There are various alternatives that one could suggest to take the pressure off of that. And one that could be suggested, and I'm not suggesting that, but maybe somebody could suggest it, is to have a site east of the Mississippi as well as west of the Mississippi. We talk about intergenerational equity. Is there such a thing as interspatial, intergeographic equity? Most of the nuclear, Frank be kind now, Frank be kind. You know, there's the Wolf River Battle. There are some other great places. Now you can say, well, that's terrible. But we have two successful high level waste disposal programs going on today. The Finns and the Swedish. And where are they located? They're located in 1,500-year-old anorogenic granites. That's the same granites that run from right across the United States and up through Labrador and over to the Baltic shield. So they're putting it in there, and it looks like they're going to be successful. So maybe we're not going to be.
There are municipalities that volunteered for the project.
Well, you know, if we look at if we, you know, I, maybe Winston Churchill was right. I don't know.
Yeah, so you're suggesting that a lot of the political problem of getting Yucca Mountain going and doing something is that this is really disposal of waste is backing up our ability to move ahead with new nuclear facilities. Isn't it? What about the notion that whatever is going on politically, and until we can get this settled about the long-term geologic storage, there's plenty of opportunity to just do on-site dry storage of the stuff coming out of the pools, and maybe there's not such a pressing need, that this isn't the thing that's backing up the potential to expand nuclear power.
Yeah, that's an approach that has mm-hmm. been suggested, and it was about to go into law at one time, and far as I'm concerned, it was good that it didn't. If I were a terrorist, I would think that any waste that was sitting out on the surface of the earth would be a great target for me. I mean, you know, despite all of the protections that are imposed. I think that I take my garbage out every Monday morning. And I think maybe we ought to take our garbage out every Monday morning, too. You know, I don't think this is a viable solution. It's really that no action, and you know, and that is in the long run. At what point are you going to say now it's going to go in? Okay, maybe it's cooled down, not so radioactive, but when is it going to go in? Well, there'll never be a good time for it to go in. It's our problem. We should fix it. Excuse me for getting vehement, but I have strong feelings about this.
I see them in our meetings. Any other questions for Bill?
Well, thank you very much.
Joe, thank you.